Okay, it looks like we're in business here. All right, thanks for having me here and giving me the chance to talk to you today. What I'm going to talk to you about today is work I've been using a femtosecond laser to perform neurosurgery on worms, on these little C. elegans. And that allows us to do two things. One, to dissect the neurocircuitry of the worm, or the behavioral neurocircuitry of the worm, and then also to watch these neurons grow back, so we can study neural regeneration in the worm. There's a clock there. But before I get to bacteria, or worms, I'm going to talk just briefly about bacteria. That's where I started working in bacteria. And I bring up these guys because they're probably the best understood behavioral system out there. E. coli bacteria sense chemicals in their environment and move towards certain chemoattractants away from chemorepellents. The way they do that is to perform a biased random walk, right? Because they're so small, about a micron in diameter. Oh, and please ask questions as I go, because there's probably lots of different backgrounds here, and I may be talking about things people haven't heard of before. Thanks. So bacteria is about a micron diameter. And Brownian motion, of course, randomizes its local environment. So it can't measure a chemical gradient just by analyzing the concentration in its head versus its tail and say, oh, I need to go to the left. What it needs to do is sample space and then decide, right, in time as it's moving through space, whether or not life's getting better or worse. And the way it does that is a random walk. It does a series of straight runs and then a random tunnel and then tumble, completely randomizing its orientation, then running off another direction. If the life happens to be getting better, it extends that run a little bit. If it's going the wrong direction, it'll shorten the run slightly, and that way it biases its random walk in the direction it wants to go. So it performs this nice biased random walk, and every part of the sensory transductive pathway is really well understood. The chemoreception, biochemical pathway that has the sensitivity it needs to be able to make these measurements, but also can adapt on the correct time scales to gross changes in its environment. So it has a broad dynamic range, but nice sensitivity. That's well understood. Then I did some experiments on the molecular motor that spins the tail of the bacteria and propels it around. So the entire system is really well understood and at a phenomenal level. And so then the idea is to take the simplest possible nervous system, that of C. elegans, and try to use the same techniques and methodology, and from my angle, biophysical techniques methodology, to study the simplest possible of nervous systems. So here's a C. elegans, for people who haven't seen it before. It's a small worm, about a millimeter long, a nematode, round worm that lives in the ground, eats bacteria. You can see they're nice and transparent, so you can see eggs here in the body of the worm. This is its mouth. It's hunting around for bacteria as it goes. The reason we like these guys, they have a simple nervous system, so 302 neurons, and every worm is exactly the same, so it has the exact same nervous system in each animal, and that nervous system has been completely mapped out. So in the 70s, Sidney Brenner and colleagues did serial section EM analysis of the entire worm, and we're able to reconstruct the entire nervous system. So we know where all the cell bodies are and all the branches of the various neurons, and then all the connections between neurons, the synapses between neurons. So that basic map is well established. Let's see here. There's the head of the worm. You can see lots of cell bodies in the head of the worm, and then this dark region here is the nerve ring, where a lot of the axons come together, and there's a lot of synaptic connections between neurons there. That's basically the worm's brain is here, up in the head. What else do I want to say? Oh, so the behavioral output, of course, is mainly just the worm's body shape. If you can measure the worm's body shape, you know how it's responding to its environment, how it's moving through its environment. And then it'll perform a biased random walk like bacteria. Yep.
It has muscles?
Yeah. So it has muscles that all along its body, and there's this nice simple network of command neurons that innervate those muscles and control contraction or it can move along. It gets more complicated up in the head of the worm, where it can move its nose more specifically. But yeah, it has muscles like any other organism. Yeah.
The 302 neurons, how many are just the muscles, how many are computing something?
Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers. It's on the order of 20 or so command neurons that are sort of spread throughout the body of the worm itself, whereas the majority are in the head, roughly 80%, something like that. And I'll talk a little bit more, there's also specific sensory neurons that sense chemicals and things like that. Okay? So that's the basic outlook of the worm. Yeah, so it'll do this biased random walk like a bacteria and basically diffuse in the direction it wants to go, but it also will perform directed motion and actually steer itself specifically in the direction it wants to go, and I'll talk about an example of that. So the other reason we like C. elegans is because all the great genetics that have been done on the organism. So they're really one of the predominant genetic model organisms out there. And over the last 20 years or so, people have studied a wide range of things on a genetic level, things like development, programmed cell death, aging, behavior, sex determination. Basically, anything that's been studied, genetics has been studied in the worm. And so that gives us this vast library of mutants. So these are well-characterized mutants that are defective in specific genes that have a specific effect on the worm. And so what that gives us is an immediate genetic and molecular handle on anything we want to study. If you want to look at muscle contraction or something like that, you can look at a mutant that's defective in a specific channel is in the muscle and see how it changes its contraction, something like that. I mean, it's hit or miss on the specifics, but basically you have some level of immediate analysis of anything you want to look at. The other thing you get is transgenic animals, so I hope that's pretty good. I guess it's pretty good. Where you can express foreign proteins in specific tissues. And primarily what we use are worms that are expressing GFP, green fluorescent protein, in specific neurons. And it just causes those neurons to fluoresce, and you can image them very readily. So here's an animal expressing GFP in just its touch neurons. So there's 6 touch neurons in the worm. You can see the cell bodies there, and then these are the axons, and then this bright band here is the nerve ring. So you can really make out the individual neurons.
How many genes
does it have? Off the top of my head, I can't remember how many genes it has. Got 302 neurons, 3,000 synapses, but genes, I can't remember.
Also, it's in 2D, right?
In the ground, it lives in 3D, right? If it's in the ground, it crawls in 3D. All our studies here are done in 2D on auger plates. So in the lab, they live on auger plates with a film of bacteria on top. They're confined to 2D, just crawl on a surface. If you look at crawling in 3D, it's interesting, but primarily everything's done in 2D. So in the lab I am, in Arabi Samuel's lab, we've been using biophysical techniques to try to understand this animal, and one of the techniques we've been developing is the use of femtosecond laser surgery. And basically what we do is just take the pulse train from an infrared pulse laser and focus it down through a high NA objective through a tight focal point. So it has pulses of infrared light that are 100 femtoseconds long and about 5 to 15 nanojoules in total energy. And the pulse length is so short and the focal point is tight enough that we get a high peak intensity of light and actually create an ionized plasma right at the focal point. So you completely obliterate the tissue at the focal point. But remember, the energy per pulse is only about 10 nanojoules or so, and they're spread out in time enough so they're acting independently. Each pulse acts independently, so we get no collateral damage at all, or very little collateral damage. And we have resolution of about 500 nanometer resolution in space. And what that allows us to do is to pick out individual axons. So here's 3 axons, all labeled, and we've picked out the middle one without damaging the other 2. So we can snip individual axons in this nervous system without doing any other collateral damage. So if you watch here, here's a movie I'll try to get to play again. Here's a cell body. Here's the axon, and it'll break right here. going to play again. Yep, so you see it just snips right there. And actually, when you snip the axon, it actually pulls apart a little bit, so that break. But you can see how nice and clean that is and how nice control we have. This is actually laser surgery techniques that were developed in Eric Mazur's lab at Harvard. They're experts in superfast optics, and now we've been working with a graduate student, Sam Chung, applying it to C. elegans. Yeah?
How do you keep the, you have a very, very high rate of temperature, even over a very short time?
Yeah.
How do you keep the damage from spreading, from the heat from transferring to adjacent cells?
Yeah. It's, the instantaneous temperature is incredibly high, right? The total energy is still only nanojoules, 10 nanojoules.
I'm curious about the temperature transfer.
Yeah, and the way it works is, and I don't know the specific details, but electrons are absorbing a multi-photon effect, absorb the energy of the incoming light. And the intensity is high enough so the rate of excitation of electrons is faster than the rate at which they can dissipate their energy through phonons to thermal dissipation. So you end up exciting all the electrons, ionizing the molecules and creating this plasma. And you actually get microcavitation and a tiny shock wave. So it isn't, it's not, if you have a nanosecond laser, a longer pulse, you're doing damage through collective heating. And then you do have thermal diffusion out and collateral damage. Here we actually, basically create a microcavitation and get a slight shock wave. So all the energy goes into this mechanical.
So there's no thermal diffusion?
There's the basic energy transfer is not thermal diffusion, yeah.
But these are very short pulses.
Yeah. No, so in theory we should be able to use one pulse. In actuality, we are using a pulse. It's a kilohertz pulse train, so it's at the length of time scale of the pulses themselves, they're incredibly spread out, and so each one acts independently. In theory, we should be able to just use one pulse and do their damage, but we use a fraction of a second, so a number of them. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's not dependent on the GFP. Yeah. There we go. Okay. So the other side of the equation is understanding the worm's behavior, and worms respond to lots of cues, mainly chemical cues, temperature cues, touch. But here's a study I've done in the worm's response to an electric field. So these are worms crawling on a auger plate. We have electric field across here, and you can see they're all going towards the negative pole, and they're doing that in a very directed way, right? And so they're here are the tracks. They're out of nine worms or so, they're all, except for this one, gets a loss for a little while here. They all do this very directed motion, and you notice actually it isn't straight towards the negative pole, but it's off at an angle, and this one either direction. And it turns out the larger the field strength, the larger that angle is. So we don't understand this angle of approach, how this correlates to the field strength. But what we're very interested in is this directed motion. You can see how perfectly straight some of these tracks are. So we have a very simple nervous system doing a very directed motion, which we can control. So looking at this, the first question, of course, was how does the worm sense the electric field? And to do that, so there's some worry that with the field strengths we have, right, they're actually fairly strong. It's about 4 volts per centimeter. We're just polarizing the worm and getting some strange electrophoresis, which is physically pushing the worm to align with the electric field. That wouldn't be as interesting as neuronally mediated behavior, where it's sensing electric field and then controlling its behavior to steer it in the right direction. So what we did was to snip all the sensory dendrites in the worm. So we used the laser to cut the sensory apparatus of the worm. So the worm here's the worm's head, and it has a number of sensory neurons in its head. You can see the cell body here, and the axon loops into the nerve ring, right, the worm's brain. And the other part, there's a dendrite that comes out to the nose of the worm, and there's little ciliae that poke through pores at the nose at the end, and that's how it senses chemicals and temperatures and various things. So if we come in with our laser and just cut, if we stained all these dendrites, and then we just cut them all, what we find is the worms no longer respond to electric field. So here's a worms following a rotating electric field. They just do a nice smooth circle. And if you cut their sensory dendrites, they no longer follow the electric field. So that was our first indication that this really is a neurally mediated behavior. So another tool we have in looking at these animals is fluorescence imaging. So in particular, looking at the calcium level, using calcium fluorescent indicators to measure neural activity using simply imaging. So the worms are so small and their neurons are so small, it's quite hard to do electrophysiology to get in there and actually patch clamp the worms, the neurons. You can do it, but you end up with a worm that's splayed open and it's not obvious what you're doing. It's much easier, and because the worm's nice and transparent, you can express fluorophores that are whose level of fluorescence depends on the level of calcium in the cell. And then you can monitor the fluorescence, and that gives you an idea of the neuron's activity. So you can see a trace here. I won't go into the details, but it's a fret-based measurement. So we basically have two fluorophores, and when the calcium levels increase, the cyan channel fluorescence goes down, the yellow goes up, and we get two signals, and we just take the ratio of those two, and that's gives us an idea of the calcium dynamics in the cell, right? Calcium is a good indicator of neural activity. So this is basically telling us the activity of the neuron. This ratiometric measurement's nice. I won't talk about it too much, but we were actually able to measure in a different study, measure neural activity off of freely moving animals. So the animal's unconstrained, just crawling around on a little auger pad. You watch, and we were following it around, watching the fluorescence from the cell body. We can measure the activity of that neuron while it's moving around and behaving. Here what we did was to express this chameleon, this indicator in specific sensory neurons, glue the worm down, and then rotate the electric field around. So spinning the electric field around, and ask what sort of activity we see. So here's the electric field spinning around. Right? And you can see you get nice calcium increases that are correlated with specific direction of the electric field. So you get directionally specific calcium activity. Here's the same data plotted in a polar plot. So you get a large activity when it turns out when the nose of the worm is pointed towards the positive pole. Right? So that's in the opposite direction the worm wants to go. It wants to orient itself so the nose is at the negative pole. That makes some sense because the neurons that we're getting a nice signal from one of which is actually a rudimentary pain sensor. So it's things that senses chemicals the worm wants to avoid, or high osmolarity, or nose touch. So this neuron gives us a nice response to the electric field, and by the worm orienting itself in the other direction, it's trying to minimize the activity of this neuron. So it's trying to avoid pain on some level. So that can be one interpretation. Yep. So these worms can't move. They're glued down, and we're just rotating the electric field around.
If in a
straight field, what I've done is I've actually fixed the direction of the worm and fixed the direction of the field, and then modulated the intensity of the field strength. And what you get is maximal signal that's roughly proportional to the field strength when it's pointed in this direction. And then it just falls off as it goes. So it says that it's not, It correlates exactly with what we see here. Yeah.
Yeah. So if they're avoiding field, they're moving in the direction of weaker field?
They're moving in... So this is the response of the neuron, right? And the worm is, of course, free... This is immobilized, yeah.
They're moving away from the field.
Away from the positive pole.
From the positive.
Yeah, so you remember those, that first movie I showed you, right? They were all going towards the negative pole. So they're orienting themselves in the field. I may have misspoken a second ago. So what they're doing here, this is the response of the neuron, right? You know, rotationally. The worm is behaving so that it is oriented in that direction. Right? So that it minimizes the response of that neuron.
I'm trying to understand why pain is dependent on sign.
But can you comment on why the direction of rotation matters?
So that's a good point. The direction of rotation does matter a little bit. I get a little bit of a phase difference. And part of that has to do with the time dynamics of the fluorophore. It's on the order of a fraction of a second. Fluorophore's time dynamics are actually fairly slow. So the binding rate of the chameleon molecule is pretty slow, and then the off rate is slower. So that there is it's not ideal in terms of reporting calcium. No, it's not that it's rotating in. It's rotating fairly quickly here. It's just the signal you see here is lagging the actual activity of the neuron slightly. So if you rotate one way, you're going to get a lag in one direction. If you rotate the other way, you get a lag in the other direction. This is a single neuron, this trace here I'm showing, and this is a compound of, I think it was a number of worms, five or six worms, and then each worm had three or four trials to it, so it's a compound of a population. Yeah, this is the average.
Yeah. Did you change the rotation rate?
We did change the rotation rate some, yep.
Did it affect this asymmetry?
Yeah, it did to some degree, and then the faster the rotation rate, the larger the shift between the two.
Yeah. It would seem that the average gives you something more like the instantaneous response.
Yeah, the average.
The maximum response is not at zero, but rather...
No, it's off slightly, right? But you remember, the worms actually don't go directly at the negative pole. They go off at an angle. So we are happy to see that. And then me... What?
Is it the same angle?
We weren't able to correlate that, or we didn't go into it close enough to really make a measurement. But it depends on it didn't seem to change enough with the strength of the electric field, right? That angle changes, behaviorally changes with the strength of the electric field. This lag wasn't changing quite that amount. What was I going to say? No, I can't remember. Anyway. Okay, so we can snip the dendrites. We can measure activity off the neurons. So here's a movie made by undergraduates, which next week will be more timely. But so the point for this movie is just to illustrate again the control we have over the worms. Right, simply by modulating the direction of the electric field, we can make the worms do whatever we want them to do. Valentine's Day, they go into hearts. We may go with circles. We can do whatever we want. This is just indicating where the undergraduates just mark the positions of the worms every 5 seconds or something. We have a more sophisticated way of tracking them now, but this is back in the day when we were just playing around. So, but what this allows us to do is take this simple neural network and make it do the same behavior over and over and over again. And what we've done here is actually force it to make a decision. So if you shift the direction of the electric field, the worm, of course, has to reorient itself in that new direction, right? So if you give it a 60-degree shift, in the electric field, it does that in two ways. It can either do a nice smooth turn, so it's walking forward, field shifts, and then it just continues a nice smooth turn, right? And the other way it does it is you're walking, or it's crawling forward, the field shifts, and it actually backs up about a body length or so, and then reorients and goes off. So you elicit two different behaviors from the same stimuli. And the larger the field shift, the more likely you are to get a reversal, which I guess isn't too surprising, right? The whole idea, of course, of looking at a simple network like this is we can really understand how it makes this choice between one thing or other. But you like to sort of grasp onto things and look at things that will correlate in some rough way to higher organisms, right? So you're not going to study image recognition in a worm, but you can study olfaction or touch. Here we're giving it some rudimentary choice. And study a choice between two possible behaviors. And that's, of course, well, you know, we make choices all the time, and there's a lot of study at higher organisms. But here we can do it in a very simple organism. So we want to get it down and understand the neurons that are involved in making this choice between a turn or reversal. So what we did was to kill off neurons that we know affect turning rate and reversing rate in general. So you can snip axons of individual neurons, but you can also kill the neuron off completely. And this has actually been done for quite a while using more conventional UV laser. And what we did was to kill two neurons. So all the neurons, of course, have names. There's 302 of them. Each one has a name. This RIM neuron, which is an inner neuron sort of deep in the neural circuitry of the worm, is known to affect the worm's spontaneous turning rate. So if a worm is just crawling around on an auger plate, it'll make a large turn, large angle turn every so often. If you kill off RIM, you get fewer spontaneous turns. If you kill off this AVA neuron, another inner neuron, you get fewer spontaneous reversals. So just worm bumbling around will tend to reverse less often. So the question is, if we give it our 60-degree angle shift and kill off these neurons, does that bias the decision between making a turn and a reversal? Okay? And what we did, so first we kill off RIM, and we found that yes, we get fewer turns when it's missing this neuron, but the number of reversals actually doesn't increase. Instead, we get more stalls. So white here is turns, gray is reversals, black is a stall. And what a stall is basically at the instant that the field changes direction, the worm just starts to twitch. It stays in place, twitching sort of uncoordinated, very uncoordinated. It doesn't do anything productive for a few seconds. It basically becomes frustrated, and then it will eventually make it on its way. What we find is an increase in the number of stalls that correlate with a decrease in the number of turns. So what we think is happening is we're not biasing the decision between making a turn or a reversal, right? But rather, the worm tries the turn at the same rate or the same probability, but some of those turns are frustrated because it's missing some of the machinery to make a large turn. It's missing the RIM neuron, which is involved in executing a turn. Okay? Say the thing with this AVA neuron. We kill off AVA, we get fewer reversals, but the number of turns doesn't increase. Instead, we get a larger number of stalls. And so we think the same thing's happening. We're not biasing the choice, but we're actually affecting the worm's behavior or worm's ability to execute a reversal. So some of those reversals it tries to do just become uncoordinated and it stalls out.
How many neurons are involved in the task?
Roughly speaking. So what we're looking at here is a subsection of the neural network or the worm, basically starting with the sensory neurons that we got a nice signal off of, and the ones that we really got a large signal off of and have other data to suggest that they're the primary sensory neurons are these two here. And then you can just look at the whole downstream partners. And so the two neurons we killed off here are the ones farther downstream, and they seem to be affecting execution for the maneuver.
And so
how many dendrites you have?
So these connections, all the connections they make, or do they have other connections?
So yeah, no, these are a subset of the connections they make, of course. Just to be able to display it, you sort of
roughly do they have 10 dendrites or 10,000 dendrites?
So roughly there's, let's see, there's 7,000 different synapses between neurons. So 7,000 independent connections between neurons. So any individual neuron will have on the order of 10 different synaptic partners. Yeah. And of course, it varies on the neuron. But yeah, so you can look at the entire neural network. The arrows are chemical synapses, and these blunt ends are gap junctions. There's essential electrical connections between the possible neurons. And we found here that, at least for these two neurons, we're affecting execution of that maneuver, which suggests that the choice between a turn or reversal is being made higher up, either in these sensory neurons themselves or this first layer of inner neurons. So we're very interested in looking at this handful of neurons, using all our tools of snipping axons or killing off cells, you know, recording calcium levels, to understand how this handful of neurons takes a certain stimuli and falls into basically one of two states. Do I, you know, instigate a reversal, or do I make a nice turn? All right? And it's, you know, we're talking about 5 to 10 neurons, and we really have a simple, tractable situation.
AID neurons play a very simple role. If you destroy that one, would it just stop reacting?
Unfortunately, we haven't actually started to do that, but that's obviously the thing to do, right? If you kill off AIB, what works? What doesn't work? We've killed off actually other neurons that weren't as closely tied to these neurons, but have been well studied in other strategies like response to temperature and chemicals, and found they didn't have an effect. So that was in alignment with what we're seeing here, but we really need to go in, kill off AIA, kill off AIB, you know, measure turning rates, things like that. Yeah.
I didn't understand. I thought this map was something given from this node.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
It's something you've killed off certain other
neurons. Yeah.
And how did you know that you were suspecting they would have had an
effect? Well, it's more historical in terms of what this a couple other neurons have had a large effect in other behaviors, chemical chemotaxis, thermotaxis, and things like that. Well, in partially because the experiments were done in parallel, in that we were doing some of these ablations at the same time we were identifying sensory neurons. So at the end of the day, they didn't match up exactly. And if we'd known the exact sensory neurons, of course, we would have looked at these more exactly, or more looked at those first rather than the other ones. But it's also the culture of what neurons have been looked at before. You know, the fact of killing off this neuron in thermotaxis, let's look at electrotaxis to see if it has the same effect. So that's why we started there.
So actually, you had to map out this.
The map is there. It's known, right? We had to identify which neurons were sensing.
What do you mean by killing off? Actually destroying the neurons?
So we can do two things. Yeah, we can do the axon snipping that I was talking about, or if you can kill off the entire neuron, basically you ablate the cell body as it's developing, and the entire neuron will die.
And you do that also with the electrophoresis?
Yep. Yep. No. It's you basically trigger biological process for a cell to kill itself off. So if you damage the DNA enough, it will kill itself off. Yep.
Does the axon go back?
Aha! Perfect. So the other thing we can look at, rather than looking at the circuitry, is watch these axons grow back. Takes a little while to get going here, and I'll actually talk about this again, but there it goes.
What's the time?
It's a picture every half an hour, so it's about a 15-hour movie. This is GFP, yeah, so it's expressing GFP. Right, so you can snip the axons and they will grow back. So, sorry, the cell body is about 10 microns or so. So why, of course, neuroregeneration is very interesting in the medical community, basically because our central nervous system, our brain and our spinal cord won't recover from damage. So if you break your back and you can't feel your legs, there's a good chance you won't recover from that. That's been known since the time of the Egyptians, describing that there. And modern medicine really hasn't made large advances in that regard. It's interesting, in your peripheral nervous system, so in your arm, if you cut axons, they will grow back. So in some cases, neurons can grow back, in some cases they can't. The idea is, how can you coax the central nervous system to regenerate? And people do experiments in vertebrates, in mice, cutting the spinal cord, and this is a picture 8 weeks later. You can see you don't get much regrowth whatsoever, but you also see how complicated it is. You're talking about thousands of axons here. You physically damaged it. So every time you do it, the damage will be slightly different. You get different scar tissue. And you can contrast that with what you can do in C. elegans. In C. elegans, you can pick your target neuron and every worm find that neuron, come in and snip it at exactly the same place every time, and then just look 24 hours later to see how it's regrown. So this is a touch neuron in the body of the worm. It's got the cell body right here in the center, and then it sends an axon down to the bottom of the worm, which then, once it hits the bottom worm, it grows along this ventral nerve cord up to the nerve ring where it makes all its connections. What we're doing is cutting it halfway down. And then here's a picture 24 hours later. You get this nice outgrowth, and then this big growth cone, this big fan-like structure at the end, which is growing along and exploring space. You can see this one, it hasn't, its first goal is to reach the bottom of the worm again. It hasn't done that yet, but a lot of times they do. So C. elegans is really sort of developing into a nice model organism for studying regeneration, partially because of the simplicity of the animal and the nervous system. And then we can couple that with the genetics. What we can do is just repeat that surgery in 30 different worms, cutting this AVM neuron halfway down its projection, image it 24 hours later, and just put dots at the end of the new axon growth. So we put a blue dot at the end of the longest and brightest axon growth, and then red dots at the secondary branches. And you can superimpose all these dots on a little schematic. So here the green is the original shape of the neuron. You can see about 60% of the time it successfully makes it back to its first goal, that ventral nerve cord. Sometimes it doesn't. And then you get these secondary, lots of secondary branching. But you really get a sense of the specific regrowth of this neuron. And then, of course, you can just start looking at mutants that you'd suspect might have an effect on this process. So here we're looking at regeneration in adult worms. We performed the surgery in a young adult worm, but the first place to look for defects or control mechanisms of this. Question?
Just scanning the pictures, yeah. I see the rectilinear coordinates there. Is this accidental or?
So these are compressions, yeah. So the worm is cylindrical, right? The neuron we're looking at is a touch neuron, so it's at the side of the worm. And the cell body is basically in the center, and the axon grows along the surface of the worm. So if you're looking in a microscope, of course, there's a three-dimensional detail to it. It's along the surface of the worm. These are basically, we just taken stacks and projected them all down in the XY plane. But you can, because you know it's growing along the surface of the worm, you can reconstruct the length and the specific three-dimensional growth profile, which at the level we're now analyzing here may or may not be important. We actually did that, but it's a subtle effect compared to the effects we were seeing from various mutants. But yeah. This is a 2D compression of the three-dimensional growth.
So for it to become functional again, does it actually have to be used in the other brain?
So people have seen functional regeneration in certain neurons. They've snipped the axons and that control the worm's reversing behavior and seen the worm then be able to recover. We haven't seen that. So especially in this neuron, I've cut it, and presumably it needs to grow down to the ventral nerve cord and then all the way back up to the head of the worm where in that nerve ring where it makes all the connections. And I've looked, but I haven't seen functional regeneration yet. We've seen in other neuron types the presynaptic and postsynaptic markers expressed in the outgrowth. So, right, to make chemical synapses, it has to have the machinery to form a synapse and expressing that in those outgrowths. But I haven't yet found an example of obvious functional regeneration. I'm still looking. So what we can do is look at mutants, just and look specifically at mutants that affect neural development. So development in the embryo of the worm, and here we're looking at genes that affect the guidance, axon guidance. So when it's developing, it has to do the same thing, right? It has to know to grow straight down. And these two guidance molecules are known to affect the directional guidance in development, and they seem to have a similar effect here. We knock out this netrin molecule, we get straight growth forward and backwards, but it doesn't grow down. And the slit molecule, the neuron's growing in the wrong direction more often than in the wild type, grows to the top. We also found genes that actually affect the total outgrowth, so the ability of the neuron to grow at all. And let's see. So here there's these scatter plots of the results, right? Here's the wild type that makes it back to the first. Once it hits the ventral nerve cord, there's other neurons there that are also labeled, so we lose the new growth, at least in what we were doing here. But you can see for the netrin, you get these straight growth frontwards and backwards. The slit, you get growth to the wrong side. These two guys, you get just scattering around the cell body itself because you don't have much outgrowth at all. And they're fairly interesting because in development, they affect axon guidance. So the axons grow out normally, but they're growing the wrong direction. Here, they're playing a more fundamental role and affect the ability of the neuron to grow at all, to regenerate at all. Yeah, so they have, each one of these has a certain percentage of the worms will be defective. And we actually go and pick the worms that develop normally, although they are the mutants. So we start with the same morphology to begin with, right? But you can see the power of the C. elegans and the genetics. You can just look through all these candidate mutants and really understand the role each one's playing. You can also do screens and look for novel mutants that are going to affect regeneration. Yep. No, we've done it in developing worms, and we could go to older worms, too. We find that typically developing worms regenerate better. So the ventral score for these neurons had a better success rate with the ventral nerve cord. So the closer you are to development, the stages, the better you're going to regenerate, which I guess is obvious to start with. But you know when certain genes turn on and off, in cases, and you can start to correlate that with regenerative behaviors and things. Yeah. Yep.
A few slides back, you had mentioned that when you ablate an exon, then the worm kind of gets into the stall.
Yeah.
So, is it possible? Like, I just wanted to find out if the time duration in which the worm stays in the stall state, mm-hmm. does it correlate with the time it needs for the exon to grow back?
Oh, no. So this is 24 hours, so a number of hours. It's stalling for a number of seconds. Those experiments we were doing were in in worms, where we've killed off the neuron completely. So it's missing the neuron. If you damage the nucleus in the DNA, the neuron will go into a biological process apoptosis where it kills itself off. So just missing those neurons completely. Right. Okay. So the other thing we like to do, though, is actually look at the dynamics of regrowth. And this is this movie I was showing you earlier where we've cut the axon here. Right? It wants to grow back down. But it doesn't do that directly. It sends out this growth cone, which explores space. It'll go one way, and it creates branches. It does that, right? It creates a branch, and watch, this will actually prune off there. So it's exploring space, going one direction, going the other direction, and then pruning off unwanted branches. So one thing we're very interested in doing is studying the spatiotemporal dynamics of neuroregeneration in vivo, right, in the intact worm. Here's another movie. It's not quite as spectacular, but the reason I show you this is because this was done in an alive, awake animal. It's just physically held in place. This one, it's alive, but we've anesthetized it so that it can't move. These were done in microfluidic channels. So these are actually movies here. Worms, they're just channels a couple hundred microns wide, and they taper down to a few microns. You can see they wiggle their heads and their tails, but they can't move their body. And they're amazingly still, actually. And they can come in with the laser and snip axons in this completely alive, awake animal. And we can take a image every half an hour and generate those time-lapse images. This is work we're doing with George Whitesides. They actually developed these worm traps for other experiments, and we're starting to use them for our imaging experiments. Yeah. Well, you grow them in there. No. There's actually 128 of these channels in a row, and there's just an array, an input array, and you just hook it up. These microfluidics are amazing these days. You just hook it up with a little plastic tube that you've injected C. elegans into, and just flow them in under negative pressure. Yeah, and just flows it in. What's that?
Flow them in full growth.
Yeah, in this case, you can full grown. They also are developing little worm houses where you flow in a baby worm, and it grows up and gets stuck in your house. And you can imagine having your house here and a trap. You suck. You do a behavioral test on your worm in its house, suck it in the trap, do surgery on a specific neuron, blow it back into its house, and measure its behavior again. So. That's sort of in the future someplace, but so we can generate lots of movies in this way. This also will greatly increase just throughput for analyzing, just taking static pictures every 24 hours, because you have 100 of them in a row. You can do 100 worms in one night rather than 10 or 20 that I've been doing now. So here are the traces. So this is just the outgrowth of each individual neuron in 14 different wild-type worms, and the skinny lines are individual neurons growing out. And it's quite stochastic, right? As we saw in those movies, they grow and they shrink, they grow and they shrink. But if you look at the average, it's pretty constant. It's pretty much a constant 3 microns per hour or so, and it starts almost at the time of damage. Here's just a distribution of the growth rates, and you can see a lot of this negative growth or shrinking is happening as well as positive growth. And of course, there's some average, a positive average, but you can see how stochastic it really is. And then what you can do is look at a mutant of interest. So here's, we're looking at this SED3 mutant, and we've done the same thing. Now these are just the average traces for outgrowth after we've snipped the axons. And you can see, right, wild-type normal worms grow pretty constant, but this SED3 mutant, for the first 4 or 5 hours, you don't get much growth at all. So this mutation affects the initiation of neuroregeneration. After that, it actually grows at a fairly small rate. So what is SED3? SED3 is actually involved in apoptosis, or programmed cell death. So during development, certain cells are programmed to die off, right? As we develop, as embryos, we have webbed fingers initially, and then these cells die off, so we end up with independent digits. SED3 is involved in that process. it's actually a caspase that helps to chew up the cytoskeleton of the cell. And it looks like it's playing some role in the initiation of neuroregeneration, so it may be necessary to, when a cell is damaged, it has to, of course, reorganize its cytoskeleton to send out this growth cone. And SED3 looks like it may be playing a fundamental role in that. Yep.
Do you see the same effect with SED4?
Yeah, a worm person. yeah, we see the same effect with SED4, but the farther you go up in the pathway, the less effect you have. We've seen the same effect with different caspases, although not quite as strong as this. And we also looked at engulfment genes, which some of which have effects, some of which don't. So we're looking at basically, you know, all the cell death genes.
The reason I ask is whether regeneration requires basal activity of these caspases, or whether the whole cell death amplification
is necessary.
Sort of cascade is necessary.
Yeah, and it looks like at least the first couple steps, you know, because right. SED3 is basically the end game, and then the first upstream partner, SED4, is necessary. Yeah. Okay. So I think I'm getting there. Yep. So the last thing I want to talk about today is combining the calcium imaging I was talking about earlier with axon regeneration. So we can express our calcium indicator in a neuron. Watch the cell body and then snip the axon and see what happens to the level of calcium in the cell when you've damaged it, right? And so that's what we did here. The red arrow is the point at which we cut the axon. And we get this instantaneous large increase in calcium that lasts for about 30 seconds or so and then dissipates down the baseline. So one fundamental question is, how does the neuron know that it's been damaged and know that it needs to start to regrow, right? Some neurons can regrow, at least in humans, and actually we've seen this some in C. elegans as well. Some neurons do grow back, some neurons don't. How do the ones that do grow back know that they've been damaged and initiate this process, and are the ones that don't grow back, is that part of the reason why they don't grow back? And a good candidate for the signal for this process is calcium, or at least in part is in calcium. We've looked at mutant, or at least a single mutant that is defective in calcium regulation in the cells, and we find that the CRT1 mutant doesn't regenerate neurons as efficiently as wild-type mutants. So it's pointing that calcium does play a fundamental role in regeneration. And now we can actually look at the calcium signal in response to damage. So we can play little games where we have the cell body and we just snip at different distances out from the cell body. If we cut very close to the cell body, within 10 microns or so of the cell body, you get this initial increase in calcium, which is sustained for a long time, you know, number of minutes, if not forever. And these cells actually tend to die off. So if you cut too close to the cell body, the cell will tend to just die off completely. And that may be what we're seeing here, is basically this signal for cell death. If we cut a little farther out, of course, we get this nice regeneration, and we have a different calcium signal. We get this big increase in calcium, and then it dies off after about 30 seconds or so. If we cut even farther out, something interesting happens. We get this big calcium transient here, but it's delayed by, you know, more than a minute, actually. So there looks like there. I have some other evidence that the point serves is that at the point of damage, we're initiating a calcium wave that is slowly propagating down towards the cell body. Right, it's much slower than free diffusion. Free diffusion on that length scale is going to be seconds. So this is some biological controlled mechanism. There's opening calcium channels or releasing internal calcium stores. And so now, you know, very interesting looking at. Yep.
You're just measuring the fluorescence in the cell body, is that?
Yeah, at this point, that's what we're doing. I have done just, you know, initial measurements, trying to measure right at the point of breaking. And the signal isn't quite as big, but I do get an initial signal right at the point of breaking. I don't have it here.
You can't image the whole.
I should be able to image. Should be able to do the whole thing, yeah. Should be able to watch the whole dynamics all along. If we improve our optics slightly and things like that. But I've been able to measure right here and see an initial small, I mean, it gets smaller signal, but you get initial pulse here that's instantaneous, and this one's delayed, so it looks like this nice wave. Yep.
What is the physiological range of calcium?
Yeah.
What does calcium do sort of in peacetime there?
In peacetime, calcium does lots of things. The pertinent thing here may be necrosis. So there's a process in that cells have and neurons have that if they are damaged too far, they kill themselves off. And I don't know the actual physiological numbers of the calcium level, but basically it's been shown that calcium is used as signal to as the initial steps of necrosis, so going into the cell death pathway. So a neuron, and that's what I think we see here, is we're just triggering necrosis. And
I'm trying to understand, so these are presumably spiking neurons, and there'll be some calcium response to spike trains.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand how the magnitude of change of calcium here, how does it compare to your regular electrophysiology?
Yeah. Well, so a couple things. First of all, the C. elegans neurons actually don't spike. So it's a major difference between vertebrates and C. elegans. Presumably that's because they're small enough that they don't need to propagate the information long distance. There's no reason to have a spiking mechanism. But it means they work off a graded response. So in basic neural activity, calcium controls synaptic release, or the end game, how many synapses they're going to release into the downstream partners. Here, we're getting much larger signals than we get just in the level of fluorescence. It's hard to measure the total calcium because a lot depends on our level of expression of the marker. So if you have more marker, you're going to get a bigger response, bigger signal, but it may not be due to larger levels in calcium. It's just that you have more fluorescent molecules you're looking at. And these are non-integrated lines, so each one's going to be slightly different. And certainly from cell to cell, it's hard to tell because your expression levels are different based on which promoters you're using and things like that. So measuring... Test the. It's pretty hard, yeah.
What's the equivalent of electrophysiology in the normal, right?
Yeah.
Normally, it would just stick an electrode and.
Yeah, right. You get a nice, clean measurement. Yeah, yeah.
That's why you use these calcium sensors.
Yes. Right.
So I'm just asking, what does one see, or has it been done, that people use the.
Right. The thing that.
In response to a normal stimulation of the.
Yeah. So. The nice thing to do is actually do the measurements in parallel would be the end game, right? Do electrophysiology and calcium imaging off the same cell simultaneously, and then you can start to measure those things you're talking about. But really, it's at the level of measuring relative calcium concentrations in specific cells, and you can't compare and contrast signals from different cells. You're just looking at activation levels based on calcium. Yeah, so you can't get at those raw numbers. Yeah. Yep.
Okay, using the touch neurons, could you just sort of touch the warm body and do the recording and get a feel for what the effects to all that calcium activation and compare to a basal level?
Yeah.
And then compare what the response is.
Yeah. Yeah, for so this would be a good place to do it, right? Because we could take, if not the identical worms, at least worms that are expressing at the same level, and do a touch experiment and just touch the side of the worm and record neural activity, and then do a laser snipping experiment and record the same calcium signal and compare the two. My guess is this is much, much larger, but that's just sort of off of the size of the signal I'm getting and no strong measurements. Yep. So that's pretty much what I had to say. I just a couple little slides to say that there's life outside of worms. You can do this in zebrafish. So here we've cut an axon, and it's growing back. And you can do this in cell culture, cutting axons without damaging the cell in any other way. And then to wrap up, you have I talked to you about the femtosecond laser, how it gives us submicron resolution so we can snip individual axons. Talked a little bit about the stereotyped simple morphology of the C. elegans nervous system, so it's a perfect place to do these, you know, highly precise, highly repeatable surgery experiments. And that allows us to do two things. Analyze the behavioral neurocircuitry of the worm, and we can combine that with the optical neurophysiology and mutant analysis, and then quantitative behavioral measurements to really understand how this neurocircuitry performs specific tasks. And then also we can look at the neurons going back in vivo in the intact animal, look at different mutants and do time-lapse analysis, and then are starting to do this calcium imaging. So the people I've worked with, I've done this work in Eric B. Samuel's lab at Harvard, and these are graduate students and undergraduates, or graduate students and postdocs to help me out. Eric Mazur is in the physics department at Harvard, is an optics lab, and they were really the first ones to start ablating biological tissues with these femtosecond lasers. Working with Sam Chung, a graduate student of his, we were applying it to C. elegans. Harrison Gable is actually, my brother is at MGH, helped me do a lot of the genetics to express these calcium indicators in the specific neurons that we are interested in. So basically constructing the animals. Then I'm working with Monica Driscoll on that SED3 project, looking at the role of SED3 in regeneration. I worked with Che Chang at McGill on the initial experiments in regeneration, and looking at the axon guidance mutants, things like that. And that's it. What fraction of the laser energy is actually absorbed? I don't have a good answer for you on that one. It's nice because it's infrared laser light coming in, so the absorption into the tissue outside the focal point is minimal.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, is how you get that.
Yeah, so it's really because you have, you're right, I haven't done the measurements, but my guess is that the fraction of energy is really incredibly high in terms of the efficiency of the process. And it's because you have this amazingly intense light coming in at the peak of the pulse that you get, it's a multifold photon absorption process. And then once the ions start to, or the electrons start to ionize, you get this plasma, which is really very absorptive to light. And so the whole thing, compounds upon itself.
Yep. So what do you think might be going on with your attempts to get the functional regeneration? It seems like once you get a connection and you're snipping along an axon, it ought to, given enough time to get signals and so forth.
Well, I haven't tried hard enough to start with. And there's some caveats and things that I need to, I've just been learning about where to cut the cells and things like that. It's not obvious to me if C. elegans really need the whole entire apparatus to regenerate neurons in their wild life, right? Are they going to end up breaking individual axons? We, of course, live a long time and we tend to damage ourselves. Good idea to be able to regrow neurons. I don't know if C. elegans really needs that apparatus, or if this is just where, of course, it has some ability to modulate itself and keep itself as the worm grows, or you know, physiological change, it has to, the neuron has to be able to adapt to that. Is that, is this just a triggering of those mechanisms?
But it is regenerating.
It is growing back for sure.
So
yeah.
It has to have some functional thing.
Yeah. So hopefully, we'll see that it. I'll really convince myself that it's functionally growing back for 7. I can show you pictures. Oh, they're not overly impressive, but. So actually, here's pictures of, if we cut neurons in the head of the worm, they tend not to grow back. So here's one of these sensory neurons. We've cut the axon right there, and 24 hours later, it doesn't show much regrowth at all. So some neurons tend not to grow back, ones in the head. Most do, actually, and then, here are images of HSN, which is a neuron that controls egg laying in the worm. And these red dots are actually postsynaptic markers, so it's downstream partner. Looks like it's actually forming growth, and we have these, you know, postsynaptic markers in close approximation. This is actually a presynaptic marker on the neuron we cut. So it looks like there's at least some attempt to form connections there. But we haven't, at least on the behavioral level, haven't been able to really verify that.
Amphid neurons regenerate better?
They tend to regenerate worse. So we've seen those, right? The one I showed you were amphid neurons. Both the dendrites and the axons tend not to regenerate much at all.
And so the motor neurons, they...
Motor neurons, everything else with like that touch neurons have grown back nicely, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
I'm wondering about the electric
field.
So are these sensory neurons also responding to pH?
So we've looked at just changed the ions in the solution and found that the response doesn't depend on specific ion. They do respond to pH. They are capable of responding to pH. I can't remember the specific neurons that respond to pH off the top of my head. But as far as we can tell, it's not a specific ion or specific current. It may be, you know, that we're simply... if the worm is basically a bag of salts and you put it in an electric field, of course you're going to get all the free ions going to the end of the worm to basically screen the internal part of the worm, and you'll have a large field drop across the edge at the front and the tail of the worm, right? And that's where these neurons are poking through the nose. Well, it's fairly, they're strong, right? They're 4 volts per centimeter, 6 volts per centimeter, so they're really quite strong. So it may be that the worms actually sense electric fields in the wild. They're not going to see 4 volts per centimeter in the wild, but there's small electric fields around plant roots. And the worms want to find bacteria that tend to live around plant roots. So this may be, you know, artifact of a much more sensitive behavior that they perform at much lower strength, field strength. So there may be sensory, you know, actually electrical sensory apparatus that exists. A lot of animals, certainly, you know, aquatic animals have that. But yeah, it's a mystery. Yep. Yeah. We haven't looked by EM, and that'd be a very interesting thing to do, is actually look at the damage we're doing. What we've done is shown, and I showed you a picture there, that we have in that dendritic bundle, we have lots of actually dendrites right next to each other. And we can damage one dendrite that affects the temperature sensation of the worm, but not affect its neighbor, which is involved in osmotic sensation. So we're showing that we damage one neuron versus neuron, other neuron. You can also stain these neurons. You just put an external stain in the or surrounding media, and the amphid neurons will incorporate them into their membranes. And so we can snip an individual axon and see that we can stain its neighbor without staining the one that we snipped.
Okay.
that's we sort of proved to ourselves that we're damaging specific neurons. Now, we have to, you know, every experiment's a little bit different, and you have to make sure you're aligned up nicely when you're shooting and things like that, but yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I was interested in your talking about choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, is there one strategy which you think is optimal? I mean, is it for...
Or is there one that...
better than the other?
Wild type, is there one that it does more often, the great turn or the backup?
So when it's in the wild, it mostly will do a random walk, although there's other examples of directed motion. So on a thermal gradient, worms respond to temperature, and they find the temperature that they like and stay there, and they'll actually do nice directed motion to stay in that isotherm. So they do directed motion in the wild. When they're doing their random walks, it's sort of a combination of reversals versus large angle bends, and I think sort of evasive maneuvers tend to be reversals, so a nose touch or a high chemical concentration of a chemical repellent, something like that will elicit a reversal, whereas a more general or a chemoattractant or things like that I think will tend to be more a smooth turn. So the reversal is more of an avoidance response in general than the turn is a steering response. And so I think worm is basically choosing between continuing on its merry way or triggering its reversal or its avoidance behavior. That's the decision it's making. And why it does that and how, how does that subnetwork make that decision is what we're trying to get at. Yeah?
Can you lower your field strength and still get the animals to respond? And an idea that maybe they're actually responding to electric field rather than just some damage of their cells?
So they stopped doing this directed motion, which is what we were looking at roughly about 4 volts per centimeter or something like that. It would be very interesting to go much lower and sort of look at field strengths that they might see in the wild, like these plant roots, around plant roots, and see if you can get some form of behavior there. That's the level at which we've looked at it now. We like this directed motion for, you can play these games with the worm and make them do specific things, so that's where we were centering our focus. Okay. Thanks.